storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Vladimir Adiz. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. How y'all doing? This generational divide, it worries me, but we've had this before. You know, starting at the beginning of the 20th century, it's the 1800s. There were major shifts in how the elite dealt with those who they considered non-elite, the ordinary masses. With the emergence of psychology, social psychology, and the psychological sciences altogether, manipulation at a physical and mental level, really starting at the psychological level, and then expanding outward, became the motivation for this upper group. Because I have read a couple of books from the time, books written by radical authors, and here I'm talking fictitious books, but with moral lessons, there is a view from that period that is often overlooked. In the post-World War I era, those psychoanalysts that had helped drive the United States into war began to turn their craft onto the public, to force the public to buy more. It's often forgotten that Americans were rather frugal. Not only were they frugal, but, and I suppose this is because of their European ancestry, where most things were crafted at home for longevity, or by guilds whom were about craftsmanship. But they were frugal and they demanded quality. They were interested in items that they could keep and possibly even pass to another generation. Marketers who wanted to sell to this public, and marketing, advertisement, and promotion were really in their nascent stages. They were just beginning to really take off. I mean, in some fashion and form, marketing, advertisement, promotion, they have always occurred, but the combination of those concepts with psychoanalytics and the psychological sciences, this was new. Along with the movement towards stirring the public in the direction of consumption, came what today is very, it's very well known. It's something we hear about every day. And that is the concept of generational difference. I had assumed that generational difference had always been a constructive portion in European history, something that was always talked about. And maybe it has been to a lesser extent. But in the early 20s, newspapers, marketers, things like that, talked very openly about a new generation coming into existence. Little did they know it would be a Depression generation. After that point, everything was defined in generations. Everything. So that generation may have been more succinctly talked about as the World War I generation in hindsight. The Depression generation obviously would have been people born born after 1930. So, you know, this obviously, these are all in hindsight. You know, that generation was significantly smaller. It was only about 15 years, and then the baby boomer generation, which happened. It's kind of ironic, though, thinking about how we reference that generation that I just called the Depression generation, 1930 to 1945. We call that generation the World War II generation, the greatest generation. For black people, that was not the greatest generation. For white folks, maybe. But if we referenced, as I think we should, that generation as the Depression, or at least the generation born during those years, as the Depression generation, it changes how we perceive them. You know, World War II did, yes, color their lives, but not to the extent that the Depression colored their lives. Guess that's splitting hairs, though. After the baby boomer generation, you have Generation X, or Y. I don't know. It's kind of up in the air for me. But that's from 65 to 80. And then you have the supposed millennials. Just such a weird period of time. But
supposedly, you know, the 20 years prior to the millennium, that's your millennials. And then what they're calling, I don't like the name, Generation Z. I really, one of the names that I read that floated around is the iGen. And I love that. I think the internet generation is exactly who these folks are. So I tend to call them the iGeners. But there are significant differences starting to emerge. There are significant differences starting to emerge among the generations. I believe, and I mean this wonderfully, that the names we have given most of these generations are incorrect. The only generation I believe we titled correctly was the flower child generation, because they are both the flowering conclusion to a capitalist, well, not really capitalist, I apologize, scratch that out, an economic dominated history, particularly going back about 100 years prior to when the flower children started to really come up. The Civil War in the United States was an economic war. It ripped apart the fusion of feudalistic serfdom, which was what the South was really based upon. They were about feudalism and serfs, which the plantations were just feudalist lands with feudal lords. It ripped apart the connection, the visible connection, between feudalism and modern industrialism. That fight was not fair. It wasn't. Even though the South almost won, they did. They did. But it wasn't fair, no. And that disconnection, which allowed for the dramatic expansion of industrialism, culminated in a 100-year process of hyperinflation of production, the desire to keep overproduction down, and then when overproduction couldn't be lowered fast enough to enable people to still work, consumerism became the order of the day. 100 years after the Civil War, you had a generation who was sick of the drive towards production, consumption, production, consumption, production, consumption, production, consumption. They were tired of that. And they rebelled like they were tired of it. Because progressives and most people I listen to don't typically take a long view of history. You know, they don't see the horizon. This, I think, has been missed. This has been missed. In the 1950s and 60s, the Civil Rights Movement really was a battle between North and South. a battle between North and South. It was another battle in the Civil War. The children that rose from that, and really rose during it, I think accurately saw that it was a battle between North and South, and took appropriate sides, while similarly saying, we do not want to continue in this destructive way. Ultimately, I believe the South won that battle. Neoconservatism spread throughout the South and then moved into the North and the West. And when I should include, it spread throughout the South in the Midwest and has never relinquished its hold from either one of those places. The South won. Moreover, it appears that the South took over both the Democratic and Republican Party. I hesitate to make this statement, but I have to make this statement. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, who helped to remake the Democratic Party, are both from the South. And both of them grew up in an era where Southern politics were really well-defined. And, you know, the definition isn't hard to see. So, you know, with that information in hand, this today's generational divide, the difference between the generations, it's not hard to see. It's not hard to understand. Because the philosophical underpinnings of the recent economic order of the past 50 years has come first from a conceptual framework that appears to have been drawn from a very eclectic, very unproven but dogmatic group in Germany. There's a book that I listened to last year in the summer on this, on the neoliberal idea, and it traced it back to Germany. And people like von Mises, but there were other individuals that came before him that are lesser known. But also, the economic philosophies, the economic principles that govern the modern era come from an obscure economist whose ideas were more in line with segregationists and debilitating black people's ability to access governmental resources and really to prosper beyond where the South was trying to keep them. You can read all about this guy in the book Democracy in Chains. His name is James McGill Buchanan. These unproven philosophies that shift power back to corporations and remove power from the government at every level. Tore a hole in the previous generation. These policies shredded community bonds and ties. They shredded social norms, cultural norms. They hollowed out communities and then blamed the victims of the system for their own victimization, pointing the finger at the victims and saying they were the real victimizers. And this is not a philosophy that only resonates with Southern elites. No, this is a philosophy that even Jamie Dimon seems to be behind. I heard a recent interview with him where he was all for austerity measures that hurt everyday Americans because they were beneficial policies to not only himself, but his friends and people who were going to be making tons of money off of those policies. But as a person known as Bernie Sanders said, you know, he's against socialism, and he is, except when it's beneficial to his bank. But I guess that's a different story. The generational difference, the present generational differences, really come from two different views of the world. The previous generation accepted without argument those premises being impressed upon them. And this newer generation, which is depthly aware of not only the harm to the environment that these philosophies have caused, but also the harm to the society, to the public, to the communities, they are aware of the problems to these places that these philosophies have caused. And I think more importantly, and I've said this before, just as my generation was aware of our parents being unhappy in the 90s. Just as we were, it was subtle, but we knew subtly that they were unhappy. We didn't know why, but we understood that they were unhappy. This generation not only understands that their parents are unhappy, but they get why. They understand why. And they don't want to see that anymore. They want to do something about that. A question I recall hearing on, there was an old post that came up on my Facebook that, I'll be honest, I had completely forgotten about. I'd written it in 2013. It came up about 3 weeks ago. And I reposted it because it was that good. It was way too good. So a father is preparing for, he's getting ready for work in the morning. And his son comes up to him, says, "Daddy, where are you going?" And he says, "I'm going to work, son." It's like, "Why? I want you to stay home with me." "Well, it's because, you know, I go to work to make money." "Okay. Well, can't you just make money here?" "No, it doesn't work that way, son. I go to work to make money to be able to pay for all this stuff. Oh, I'm sorry, I got it wrong. So he said, it doesn't work that way. Well, why do you need the money? Well, I need the money, the father says, to pay for all of the stuff that we have. The lights, the water, you know, the toys that you like to play with, the clothes that we have on. That's why I make the money. Huh. So the son thinks for a minute and says, can't you just make your own money here so you can have more time with me and mommy? And the father says, no, that would be illegal. And the son stops and thinks a minute and says, well, where does the company get its money from, you know, to pay you? Well, many places. It does business with other businesses, but it goes to the bank probably and gets money from the bank. Well, where does the bank get its money from, Daddy? Huh. I don't know, the father says. Let's Google it. So they go, they Google it. And he says, well, isn't that something? The banks get it from the central bank, the Federal Reserve, which makes it out of thin air. Why can't we make our own money again, Daddy? Well, because it would be illegal, but they can do it. Yeah, I know. Huh. I know. I remember what this was based off of. Back in 2011, I came across a lecture on fiat currency. Never even heard of the thing. And the lecture was talking about how money that we utilize in our pockets isn't actually worth anything. It's not bound to anything. That the Federal Reserve makes it out of thin air. And I remember the first time I listened to the lecture, I laughed. It's like that. Absolutely untrue. It's like bound to gold and silver and stuff, please. And then I dove in and I researched it. And I was like in shock for 2 weeks because it was true. And then I sat back and I thought about it. This was before Occupy Wall Street. This was before Occupy Wall Street. So then I sat back and I thought about it. About the number of people that lost their homes, which of course now it's far worse. I thought about the number of people that lost their homes. I thought about the trillions of dollars that were shoveled to big banks to keep the big banks alive. And I thought about all of the excuses that were made to stop Barack Obama from enacting a really devastatingly effective stimulus package. And I thought about then the idea that the money isn't even real. That they are starving people because the money isn't. Because those people don't have enough money. And the money's not even real. And it stunned my mind so much that these people were walking around thinking that they were better than everyone else because of this fictitious idea that paper has value. And as long as you take metals and you press them into coins, those also, too, now have specific values. And then I thought again about the number of people that were hungry on the street. And it blew my mind. I listened to some more podcasts over the coming, year on fair currency. And one thing that became very clear to me was that it was a lot of young people who were leading the conversation on fiat currency. that many of the videos that I watched on YouTube on fiat currency were done by people who are like 20 years old, 18 years old, things like that. There were older people than myself at the time, significantly older people than myself at the time, and some of the younger people referenced older people who I then went and checked out. But it was something that was very discerning. This newer generation had a broader understanding of the financial system than my generation did. Meaning, it was all lies to them. And that discontentment in, I think it was the early summer 2011 when I discovered this, it bled over into the Occupy Wall Street movement, which ironically did not really touch the idea, if I remember correctly, of fiat currency. Even Chris Hedges back then, I remember there were some people at his rallies, not his rallies, but his lectures, and they would have signs about fiat currency, and you know, it was just, it was a non-issue for the progressive left. It wasn't even considerable. We are in an age, though, where all of that is causing tumultuous problems in the undercurrent. Because, you know, many of the people who were big on fiat currency 8-9 years ago, they're not really talking a lot about it now. They're not. Many of those people, I'm probably confident to say, many of them probably support Donald Trump because they see the whole system as a problem, and they just want to burn it down. They're nihilists. And they assume you burn it down, you're going to be able to build something great. And instead, most of them don't have the plans, though, to do that. Most of them don't. Now, I think for this reason, this is why the generational divide has not yet hardened significantly, is because you do have many of the ideological forms left over from the previous generation in this generation. This generation has not yet distilled those ideological forms. They haven't created the philosophical philosophy, the philosophical foundation for progressivism, the new socialism. Most of them don't know how to do it. Most of them do not know how to do it. Many of this generation, much of this generation, have shirked traditional spiritualism. And so at a time when they need a spiritual foundation to reimagine society, because that's how you reimagine society, is through a spiritual integrative or a spiritually integrative vision. They don't have one, and they don't have that energy to drive one and to build one. Which is concerning to me, but I guess no generation is really ready to discard the previous generation's momentum and to build a new momentum forward. No generation is really ready. And yet, this generation is being called forward to make that work and to make it happen. The question that I think needs to be answered is, can they and will they? The humanities. This is something that is not taught very much in college anymore, high schools anymore. But it is something that I think is important. And, you know, I know I am definitely on in California, and I'm glad that I am on in California. And I'd like to put out a challenge to any of the professors out there. We desperately need a public, and I'd hate to even say this, but free, a free public internet-based, you know, humanities course. We need it. I recently found a really great course, and you know, one of the things that I love about YouTube is you can find this stuff now. It's so much easier to find than having to go to 50 different, you know, websites. But I found a detailed course. It's like 30 lectures, each one like an hour and between an hour and a half to an hour and, well, an hour and a half to 2 hours long. A detailed course on the history of economic philosophy, theory, and structure. It's fascinating. But what we need, what we honest to God need, and maybe I just haven't searched the right points for it yet, but we need a publicly available, free humanities course. That's what we need. I am not the correct person to do it. My knowledge of the humanities isn't deep enough. But for this generation, we really do need it. We desperately need it, in fact, because, you know, humanities, I think, is what's missing from the calculation. Everything education-wise is about money, money, money. Economics, economics, economics. As if economics is the end-all, be-all. Actually, what's funny is economics should be the end-all, be-all. Because of what, you know, economics is drawn from another word in, I think it's Greek. That means housekeeping. Okay, so economics should be the end-all, be-all. But they've made it all about money. Economics isn't just about money. But we need the humanities to reinvigorate social life. And I'll be honest, it's not something that needs to be done once. It isn't. And maybe ultimately it's unfair to ask professors to put their time and energy into doing something that you're really going to have to engage in doing. And you know, accept that it's not going to get a lot of publicity for probably the first 4 or 5 years. But it'll probably take that long to get the spiritual energy turned up enough in this society. But we do need it. This generation is missing not only fundamental humanities training. They're missing the principles of a liberal education. And they're even missing the idea of philosophical structuring, question structuring, critical thinking skills, things like that. All of these are dynamics that, you know, some of our more well-off professors, there's not a lot of you guys I know, but some of our more well-off professors, and maybe some of our emeritus professors, could really contribute to this generation's growth by putting those things together and making an effort to revise them each year and putting them up on YouTube. And what I would ask is, if you decide to want to take up this challenge, please, 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 please send me a link. Send me playlist links. Send me YouTube links to my email address, which I probably should, you know, go and just get a easier one so it would be easier for you guys. But my email address is Vymir Adis Ogaya. outlook.com. Call up the station that you're listening to this program on to find it. Or you can go to radio4all.net, radio, the number 4, all.net, and just look up this episode, and then, or really any of the episodes, because on each episode, if you go down to the description tab, I always include my email address, so you can reach out to me. But if you really decide to do it, please reach out. Send me a link. I'd love to see it, because it's necessary. We need it. We need it. You know, get together with the audio visual club and get yourself a little microphone, you know, a little lapel microphone, and I've been waiting for something, you know, to happen. Make it work so this new generation can build itself up and take its rightful place in history. That said, I'm going to end this episode here. I thank you guys for listening. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. I am your brother, Vimer Deese, and I will see you on the next one. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.